From 925 Mac, this is Stack Trace. I am your host, John Sandell, and I'm joined by my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How do you like that intro, Guy?
You're doing movie trailer Sandell again.
No, if I do movie trailers, it will be
in a world where spelunking happens. John and Rambo analyzes that spelunking.
Or something like that. So what have you been up to lately?
Oh, I've been doing some really cool stuff with JavaScript.
Oh, wow. Oh, and there we lost 90% of our listeners. Too bad.
Yeah, as you know, JavaScript is the future. Everything will run JavaScript.
There goes another 5%.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I've always done stuff with JavaScript. It's not my favorite language by far, but it's everywhere and it works, and there are some interesting things with the language. But recently I had to do some changes to the backend for Chibi Studio, which we've been talking about for ages now, because I've been working on this version 2 of the app for ages. And I wrote the first version of this backend in Vapor 1, so that's Swift.
Uh-huh.
And the problem is I can't use that anymore, because Vapor is in version 3 and there's no like simple migration from version 1 to version 3. And Swift on the server, as cool as it is, and I do have other stuff that is Swift on the server, like Sharecuts, which I'm updating constantly, it's not ready yet. It's an experiment, and it's interesting, it's cool, it's fun because it's Swift, and it's exciting. But for like real world production stuff where I need to iterate very quickly, it's just not the best option.
And isn't there an option to stick with an old version of Vapor? Because if you're running on Linux, for example, and you have your own container, you can just keep an old Swift version there. Or are you concerned maybe about security updates and things like that?
Yes, there's the aspect of security updates, and also you can't use the new versions of Swift, so you don't have new features such as case iterable and things like that.
Right.
So yeah, it's like you'd be in a sad place. It's like maintaining crappy legacy software.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And it was very little code. Like the amount of functionality this backend had was very limited. So, but I needed to add a lot more functionality to it. So it made a lot of sense. Like I wrote more new code than the code I already had, if you know what I mean. So
yeah.
There was no reason to keep going with that. And I had experience with Node.js before. I think when it launched, basically, I jumped in and started learning because it was interesting. And I've always liked how simple it is to make like kind of complicated stuff. We'll link in the show notes. There's this Brazilian YouTuber. He does videos on programming. But this video has English subtitles. And he made a robot that makes videos for a YouTube channel, all automatically using machine learning and stuff with Node.js.
Nice. He's like putting himself out of a job in one single final video.
Yeah, I mean, it makes like videos about Wikipedia articles. You know those videos with like a background sound and images moving around and little text snippets?
Yeah.
But it's really impressive and it's incredibly simple to do with Node.js.
Yeah,
so,
that's great.
So I've always liked Node.js. It's not like I don't like JavaScript that much, but there's one aspect of JavaScript that I wish we had in Swift, and I wish that very, very much, which is async await.
Yeah, absolutely. I love async awaits. And it's also such a huge upgrade to Node.js in particular, because like you, I've tried Node.js in the past as well. And I think it's also important to point out, like, you know, there's a lot of people who like to kind of hate on JavaScript. And there's a lot of things you can complain about when it comes to JavaScript as a language, especially the browser flavor of it that, you know, a lot of us are used to. But Node.js is a very interesting ecosystem. Like it has so much stuff. Like, there are so many packages, there's such a huge community, and the platform itself has really evolved a lot. So I think it's also important to keep an open mind and, like you did, you know, consider it as a choice. And especially like if you're trying to build something which maybe needs some dependencies or other packages, chances are high that you can find it in Node.js, right? Because it's so much more mature in that sense. But async await is such a big improvement to Node.js, because one of my biggest complaints about it when it kind of came out, and I was using it quite early on. Back then I was primarily a web developer and I was building some backends using it. It was that it was so crazy asynchronous. And every time you did anything, you had to always attach like a function, you know, what in Swift we would call like a closure, like a callback handler. And that would always generate this pyramid of doom of just callbacks within callbacks within callbacks, just to do something simple like respond to a request, create a database query, execute that, maybe like cache the response and return some JSON. That would be like five levels of nesting. But with async await, for those of you who don't know what that is, it's super nice, like syntactic sugar, if you will, on top of what's called coroutines. So you can call into a synchronous operation that will suspend your current coroutine and just enter a new one. It will do all the work and then come back again. And that way you can write asynchronous code that looks exactly like synchronous code, which is extremely nice.
And just to explain a little bit better to people who are not programmers and still listen to this podcast, when you do asynchronous programming, like you think of programming like writing commands in sequence, and those commands will run in the sequence they've been written. And when you work with asynchronous code, it's not like that. You write the code in sequence, but it's not guarantee that it's going to run in the sequence that it's been written in. And with async await, you can write asynchronous code and it will look exactly like synchronous code with just a few new keywords added to it. So it makes reasoning about the code, and even aesthetically, it makes the code easier to read.
Yeah, much less verbose. And also, like I mentioned, like you really get rid of that pyramid of doom where you have all these closures inside callback handlers, and you have to handle errors at every single stage, etc., etc. Like all that goes away with async await.
Yeah, and I kind of have that problem with Vapor 3 now, because it's all based on futures and promises, and it is very asynchronous as well. So that means you end up having these huge chains of map and flat map and casting from one type of future to another one. So I can't wait for us to have something like async await on Swift.
Yeah. Yeah, especially when you combine, like JavaScript has done, you combine futures and promises with async await, you get a super nice programming tool, right? Where you can, in your code, just like return a future, and then you can actually call that using async await. So yeah, it's I'm really looking forward to that as well. It looks like it's kind of coming to Swift, but we don't really know when. And, you know, it hasn't really been kind of fully hashed out on Swift Evolution yet. But yeah, we'll see. I would love for that to happen. But I think also that there's like a good reason we're talking now about like why these why Node.js, Vapor, etc. are so asynchronous. And there are good reasons for that, because especially when you're running server-side code, you want to be as non-blocking as possible. So when you get a request, you want to be able to handle that request, but at the same time, as you're handling it, you also want to be able to receive more requests, because you don't want that kind of worker or that process that is handling a given request to be completely blocked, because then you wouldn't scale very well. You wouldn't be able to handle traffic spikes very well. So I definitely get it, why they're so asynchronous. It's a good design, but having these language abstractions on top of it, which makes it easier to program for, I think it's very nice.
Yeah, it's like adding new cashiers at a supermarket, or adding more exits to a parking lot.
That's right, yeah.
you have parallelism, so you avoid these huge queues of stuff that's stuck waiting for something else to finish.
Yeah.
And this ties into another project of mine, which is Apple Observer, which you've been trying out recently.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to know when the new betas are coming out, like an hour ahead. So that's been really, really cool to get those push notifications on my phone.
Yeah, so it's always been just a Mac app that does everything locally. And that was like, let's call that a proof of concept of this app. And now I decided to rewrite it for iOS and do everything on a server. And it's also Node.js. And it is kind of like a micro-architecture thing because I have different services that communicate with each other. And they are all run in separate Docker containers in the cloud. So that's super cool.
That's very, very cool. Yeah, server-side development is so much fun. I still have it on my to-do list to really get into Swift on the server, really get into Swift Neo, Vapor, all these technologies. I've used them, but very, very sparingly, and I would love to just dive in and build something proper with it. It's I've been a backend developer. That's kind of my background before I became an iOS developer and all this other stuff. So I do really enjoy server-side development. There's a certain elegance to it because it's almost like everything is a pure function where you have a request coming in and you return something in response. So it's you can write really elegant code on the server side.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I know you've been doing some open source work. You're back.
I'm back in the open. Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah, it's been so much fun. I was finally able to get some time to spend on some of my open source projects because like we mentioned on the show in the past, I've kind of had difficulties prioritizing open source work, but also just like finding the motivation to get in and to kind of start fixing issues and start to, you know, review pull requests and fix stuff in them as well. Because it's kind of easy for open source to get overwhelming, especially if you are lucky enough to get some traction with some projects. It can start feeling really overwhelming, like if there's a lot of issues being filed and pull requests coming in. And, you know, I really appreciate everyone who like sends me a pull request. I mean, I still feel like it's like unbelievable that someone on the other side of the planet wants to contribute to one of my projects. I just think that's really cool. But sometimes it's a bit challenging because this person might be suggesting a feature that you might think is cool, but you don't necessarily want to take on the maintenance responsibility for that feature for different reasons. It might be complex. You might not really need it yourself, and et cetera, et cetera. So I've been thinking a lot lately about how I want to approach open source. I've started to trim things down a little bit to make things more streamlined, focus on a smaller number of projects instead of spreading myself too thin. And I think this will enable me to keep working on projects like Splash, which is my syntax highlighter, which I've been updating for Swift 5, Marathon, my scripting utility, which I've also updated for Swift 5, and Imagine Engine, my game engine, and a bunch of other projects that are really dear to my heart, and deprecating and closing down some of the other projects that I'm no longer using, and I feel like, you know, they've kind of run their course and it's time to focus on something else.
Yeah, with open source, it's very important to know when to let go.
Yeah.
You have all this stuff and it eventually becomes not useful anymore to you. And maybe it's time to retire the project when you come to that stage.
And that's completely fine, you know. And it's also important to point out that even if you as a maintainer don't want to work on something anymore, I mean, first of all, that's always fine, I think. And people can still use it. Like, people can keep using it. And if they want to change it, they can fork it and they can update it. And that's the beauty of open source. And I think sometimes we can forget that a little bit because sometimes we look at open source like this one repository that is the original. That's the only repository. Like, all other code, all other features, everything needs to go into this one single source of truth. And that's not necessarily true. And I don't think really open source should work that way. So I think having different forks is, you know, it can sometimes be a pain, but having different forks spin off in different directions, focusing on different things can really also lead to a lot of innovation. So I think that's a good thing in general.
Yeah, as an example, recently someone, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the person's name, but they forked my WWDC app for macOS. And they turned it into an app to watch videos from all sorts of Apple-related conferences.
That's awesome.
Yeah, which is something I've been meaning to do before and never got around to. And wouldn't make sense to have as a feature of the main app because the app is just for WWDC. But yeah, this person made it, and it's great. And I believe the address is conferences.digital, and we'll leave a link in the show notes.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I need to check that out. Yeah, it's so great and beautiful when someone can take something that you made and build something different on top of it. Like, again, that's what I love about open source. And I really want to kind of continue promoting the fact that even if I stop working on something, doesn't mean that the project needs to die. Like, someone else can fork it and, you know, do something with it and run with it. And even some project that is still alive, if they want to take it in a different direction, like this conferences example, that's awesome. That's like, that's why we do this stuff. Nice. So, we are going to start the main show with some follow-up, and we have some follow-up around AR, which is follow-up from you, Rambo, because you found some interesting job postings on Apple's career website.
Yeah, I always like to take a look at jobs.apple.com, because they post some job postings there, which are very interesting and intriguing, and they... I wouldn't say sometimes, I'll say almost always reveal something about what they're working on without actually telling everything, of course. But it's very interesting. So I'm going to talk about specifically two roles that I saw them hiring for there. And the first one is for a 3D UI frameworks engineer.
3D UI. What can that mean?
Yeah, because Apple doesn't have a 3D UI framework at the moment. I mean, they have SpriteKit and SceneKit, but even SceneKit, which is a fully 3D high-level framework, it doesn't have UI.
Yeah, you wouldn't call it a UI framework. You would call it... I mean, Apple usually refers to it as a game development tool, but you can even call it like just a general purpose renderer, like a rendering or graphics framework. You wouldn't call it a UI framework because it doesn't have things like buttons and lists and, you know, all the other things that you would need in a UI framework.
Yeah, and the description for this job posting says, Apple's UI frameworks define the look and feel of our software and products.
Right, so definitely not SceneKit.
Yeah, and it also says that this team is working with some of Apple's most advanced technologies, including the augmented reality, AR, and virtual reality, VR, support offered in ARKit and Metal 2.
Ooh, nice. Apple VR headset confirmed.
you will work closely with human interface designers to deliver the foundation for the next generation of user interfaces.
Yeah.
What could that mean?
What could that mean? Yeah, I think it's pretty clear here that we're looking at some form of UI kit for AR or something like that. I mean, that's definitely what it sounds like from the job description. And it's kind of funny that it's so kind of... It spells it out very much. And, you know, Apple goes to great lengths to kind of hide what they're working on. And here we have this job ad, which is, it's not really doing that. But at the same time, I also understand that they have to say what the job is about, right? They can't just say, hey, come work for Apple. We're not going to tell you anything until you sign the contract. Like, that wouldn't work, right?
Yeah, totally. they can't post, like... come work in the AR headset team.
No,
they can't say
not.
That.
Yeah.
But they also, they can't be too vague, because then how are they going to get engineers excited about the job postings?
Yeah, and also how are they going to find the right people, you know?
Exactly.
They need people who are qualified for this specific thing to apply, so that's going to be difficult if you don't tell people what it actually is that you're building.
Yeah, and combined with this, there's another job posting, which is for developer tools UI engineer. So basically means someone who's going to work with coding UI for Xcode or another developer tool. But basically the main developer tool they offer is Xcode.
Yeah, it can be Xcode or Instruments or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and they are looking for a developer tools UI engineer to help build new programming tools for domain-specific languages. This team is working with some of Apple's most advanced technologies, including the augmented reality, AR, and virtual reality, VR support offered in ARKit and Metal. So basically interface builder for AR.
Yeah, it sounds like it. But it's also interesting that they mentioned domain-specific languages, right? Where a domain-specific language is usually a way to define something within a very, well, specific domain. For example, you would use domain-specific languages sometimes to define layouts, you know, like you also mentioned, but more in a, like a code-like manner. Or you can use DSL as the short version is. Use DSLs for things like, you know, declaring your dependencies for a project or declaring your build process or something like that. That's usually kind of what DSLs are used for. So it's interesting here that they also mention that in the job description, I think.
Yeah, and other two things in the qualifications, they list experience working on developer-facing tools or editors. And another one is work closely with HI designers and internal clients to define and deliver visual programming for several domains.
Visual programming, that's something that I like. Now they got me interested. Maybe I should apply for this role.
Yeah, maybe we both should.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your listeners, if you want to apply, please do, and then tell us everything later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to these job descriptions. I think they're pretty interesting to read. There's so many interesting things here, like visual programming, like that really gets me excited because this is a bit of an aside, I guess, but I really do believe that there is definitely a future for visual programming environments. And I don't necessarily mean like the iterations of it that we've seen in the past, which is something like, you know, a node-based language where you drag and drop things, or maybe something where you have more higher level abstractions or you're defining events or something like that. But I really do believe that that's something that we haven't fully explored yet. And especially if you add on top of that with AR and VR, where you could see yourself like, you know, debugging your program in a virtual environment, that could be extremely cool, right? And imagine just there's bugs flying all around you and you have to use your unit test gun to shoot them down.
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah, so what I also wanted to speculate here with you about this is there's mentions here of like a UI framework for 3D, which we are kind of interpreting as a UI framework for AR. What do you think like UIKit could look like, or a UI framework could look like in AR? What do you think like would be the conventions, or how would it behave?
Jeez, you're asking hard questions. It's like I'm at a job interview.
Exactly. And next, can you please reverse this binary tree here on this virtual whiteboard?
How do you see yourself in 5 years?
Oh, come on, 15 years. Got to think long term here, Rambo.
The answer is with my eyes in the mirror.
Right.
But yeah, I have no idea. I mean, you'd have to be able to place controls, virtual controls in 3D space, maybe in surfaces like walls and tables and maybe in tracked objects. But how do you interact with those controls? I'm not really sure, with some sort of device or with gestures, with your voice.
With your voice, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, there are lots of questions and not many answers in my opinion.
Yeah, that's true. Going back to what we said before about this domain-specific language, I think that could be potentially, now I'm really going out I'm really going out on a chance here, but there's a chance where when you're doing 3D game development, you usually have these very separate disciplines in order to make a 3D game to come together. So you will have like artists and graphics artists who will build like the assets, like the textures, models, etc. And then you will usually have designers who will like put those things into the actual game world. So they will use some kind of 3D editor to place like enemies and place, you know, everything from chairs or roads or trees, all kinds of objects. And then you have people who will be programmers, and they will work on the kind of underlying engine. They will write usually kind of low-level code that is very high performance. But then you also have a suite of programmers or a group of programmers who usually work on more high-level scripting languages. So that's where I'm thinking here, that perhaps they will have some kind of development environment that will let you use that kind of workflow, because building a 3D world is usually a lot more complex than building something like a 2D UI. So it might require like a slightly larger team. It might require different people with different skill sets. So for example, if Xcode would enable you to write your business logic in Swift, like your core logic and your rendering code, you would have an editor where you could place 3D objects in the AR world. And then you would have some kind of scripting language or domain-specific language that people could use to script events to say, like, when the user touches this or when the user gets nearby, activate this event. And that way, I think you could end up with a pretty sweet workflow.
Yeah, I really hope that Apple can solve those issues, because when people talk about AR being the future, what I think is there are so many problems to be solved, because the 3D world and working in a 3D world is still very hard. It's not like every developer that does apps is able to do AR and 3D stuff. I mean, just modeling a simple model in good quality takes several days, sometimes weeks or even months from a professional 3D modeler, and they are extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And then you have texturing and lighting and rendering, and the placement of stuff in 3D requires some pretty complicated math, which for me at least it's incredibly hard, even with high-level frameworks like ARKit and SceneKit. So there are lots of problems to be solved if we want to make AR be as democratic as quote-unquote regular app and game development are these days.
Yeah, you would kind of think that that's what Apple is going for, right? Because they love to do these demos with these tools that are super visual, and you can just use Xcode, drag and drop, and boom, you have a AR environment up and running in 5 minutes.
Anyone can code.
Yeah, exactly. And I would also love to see that, like the democratization, as you call it, right? I think that's awesome. And I think that's a good ideal to have. So I definitely hope that they're going in that kind of direction with some kind of really easy to use tools to build these inherently complex things.
Yeah, because with regular iOS apps, we can say that they democratize app development in a way, because if you are a developer and you can learn how to use the built-in frameworks, you can do some extremely advanced stuff without knowing all the ins and outs of how everything works. Of course, it's better if you know how everything works, but if you don't, you can just use the SDK and do some incredible stuff. But with 3D related things, at least at the moment, that's not entirely true.
Yeah, that's right. All right, we're going to keep a lookout on both Apple's hiring websites, in their frameworks, in their operating systems, everywhere. Rambo has his eyes. You have many eyes, Rambo, many, many eyes. That's how you're going to see yourself in 15 years with your many, many eyes. But now we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about Apple's upcoming event that they have just announced. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor, which is our good friends at Hyper. Hyper is the company behind some of the most beloved USB-C hubs, chargers, battery packs, and other high-quality accessories for Apple devices. And just like last month, we have an awesome 9-to-5 Mac deal of the month that gives you a really great price on some of Hyper's best accessories for your Apple devices. So for March, you'll be able to get 50% off Hyper's combo wireless charger and USB-C hub, and its other wireless chargers for both your car and your home. Right now, they've got three unique Qi-compatible wireless chargers to choose from. First, you got a really cool product. It's called a HyperDrive, and it's a wireless charging stand for your iPhone. And get this, it has a built-in 8-in-1 USB-C hub featuring 4K HDMI out, gigabit Ethernet, three USB-A ports, an SD microcard slot, and you've also got USB-C power pass-through with 49 watts of power. Now, that's all for an iPhone. So that's incredibly powerful stuff. You know, just imagine what you can do with that. And the cool thing is that it runs nice and cool. It won't overheat your iPhone like other wireless chargers might. And it's also small and compact, which is great for traveling. So you've got that one. That's one kind of beast of a product. You can do many cool things with that. But they've also got simpler chargers as well. They've got their Hyperjuice wireless charging stand. I love that name, Hyperjuice. I think that's a super cool name. It has the same great design as the HyperDrive, but without that hub part. And you've also got a great wireless charger for your car as well. So make sure to check out this special 9to5 Mac deal of the month, which gives you 50% off all of those great charging products that I just mentioned. And it also helps support mine and Rambo's work on this show. All you have to do is check out the show notes, where you'll find a direct link to get these products. And you can also use the promo code 9to5wireless at checkout to get 50% off your wireless charger from Hyper. Thank you so much to Hyper for sponsoring Stacktrace. All right, so Apple have, as we record, yesterday or something like that, sent out invitations for a very special event on March 25th, which will be held in Apple Park. And the title for the event is It's Showtime. So, Rambo, what do you think it's showtime for?
I think it's showtime for the shows.
the TV shows, yeah. That makes a lot of sense, actually.
By the way, this is not the first time Apple has used this tagline for an event. I think the first time was in 2006, something like that.
Oh, yeah? What were they announcing then?
They were announcing the iTV.
Oh, right. The predecessor for the Apple TV.
Yeah, it was the Apple TV, but they had to change the name because of some copyright issues, I believe. So yeah, the tagline has been reused, but this time it has a space between show and time.
Maybe also to avoid copyright issues, because there's a US TV channel called Showtime.
Yeah, could be. So this seems to be a media-focused event. On their website, they say, like, come see the new announcements on services and products. But that could be just the generic message they use for every event. So that doesn't really say much. But there is lots of smoke around new iPads, including a new iPad mini, a new iPod Touch, and there is always AirPower.
right.
So we could see, like, I can definitely see this event being split in two, like start with the product announcements and then do the new services things, because Apple events are usually 2 hours long, and I have a hard time believing they would be able to fill 2 hours with only the new subscription stuff.
Yeah,
I hope
exactly.
They don't.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what exact subscription services they're going to show. We have some really strong indications that they're going to show the news subscription, right? Where you can subscribe to different publications, and maybe it will be an a la carte service, or there will be some kind of subscription where you get all of them for one price. But there's also a lot of rumors around a Apple video streaming service. And we know that Apple has been buying shows and movies. They've been contracting lots of people in Hollywood and the filmmaking industry to make films and TV shows. So there's definitely something in the works. And it sounds like, by this title of this event, that we're going to see something like that too. So if they do an announcement of a video service, they could also show a lot of trailers, right? And they can have, like, celebrities come on stage to talk about their new TV show, or directors or something like that. So you could definitely fill up an event, I think. But I also think, to your point, like, I don't know if Apple could do that and it would still be fun to watch. But I don't know. Like, yeah. Do you think that's something they might do? Or do you think they will show these kind of products, or one or two of them maybe?
Man, I think if they fill up an entire event just with, especially if it's just about mostly about video, it's going to be extremely boring, because it would be like just those short clips they keep showing, and they would show like the trailer for every TV show they've been working on. That would be super boring.
Yeah, I guess like there's a very different audience for that. And it's going to be interesting to see also what kind of people they invite to this event. Like, what will the press coverage be? Because if they're going to demo like news things and video streaming, well, that's going to be mostly for that kind of media, right?
It's going definitely to be definitely not Steven Spielberg.
Right. Yeah, he's not a fan of streaming services, I've heard.
Yeah.
So we're going to do our poker episode, and that's going to be the next episode before the event, where we are going to bet on what exactly we think is going to be shown at this event. But I also want to hear from you, Rambo, like, before we play poker about this on the next episode, do you have any other, like, speculations or things that you are hoping to see?
You're trying to fish information for the poker, right?
I don't know, maybe. I'm not going to say anything.
Yeah, but basically what we've been talking about for a while now, there will be the new magazine bundle subscription, maybe a separate Apple News subscription for other things. There will be the media subscription for movies and TV shows. Maybe something about games, we don't know. And it's going to be interesting to see what comes out in terms of software to support those subscriptions, because we know that iOS 12.2 is probably coming out probably after the event. And one of the reasons why I believe there are going to be new products announced is because iOS 12.2 will have support for new products. And the timeline of the betas lines up with a release right after this event, like a GM release right yeah. after the event. So, but there are also software features not related to new physical products, but related to the new services, which are being worked on this new release. And yeah, we'll see. But mainly, I think that the big news of this event will be the TV shows and movies subscription service. And yeah. maybe also like an Apple Prime type of subscription that gives you everything Apple does.
Yeah, that would be very cool. I would like that. Because when they say in the description that you mentioned that there's going to be updates to the products, that could also just mean that they make an actual update to an existing product, right? So that could mean yeah. like, oh, the Apple TV now gets this extra app for this new content, or on the iPad, you now have a revamped news app or something like that. That would technically be an update to products, right? But not new products per se.
Yeah, and there's also the aspect of, what about access to these services on the Mac? Will we see an update to iTunes to watch the new TV show stuff?
Or will we see a new Marzipan app?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at this point, I surely hope they give us Apple Music and the TV app, even if it's Marzipan, because it would be better than iTunes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it would enable them also to start breaking down iTunes, which I'm sure they want. I'm sure that's like, you know, whenever you are maintaining a big, large legacy system, you always want to break it down into smaller modules and, you know, start creating things that are easier to maintain. And I would be very surprised if that is not on the list of things for them to do, is to finally break up iTunes into smaller pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So we're going to save the bulk of the discussion for this event to the next episode, which will be out next week, where you're going to hear us play poker about what we think is going to happen. But before then, feel free to tweet us your suggestions, your speculations, or anything that you would like us to talk about for that episode. And we'll see if we can do that. But let's move on now with the show. You know, the show must go on. And we're now going to do
the Rambo Report.
So, Rambo, tell us, what do you have for us this week?
So, not too much stuff this week, but I did post some new things to 9to5 Mac this Monday. And I combined some new findings and some things we've been talking about, and two of the exclusives we gave on the latest episode.
Stacktrace exclusive!
Exactly. So, the two new interesting things are activity rings in wallets and some more AirPower stuff.
Yay, your favorite. The product yes. that keeps on giving, even though it isn't here yet. This must be the Apple product. It must have some kind of record of having the most kind of appearances in leaks and rumors and stuff without being shipped, right? It's just crazy how much AirPower we've seen without actually seeing it.
Oh, yeah. So there's been this report by the Wall Street Journal, I think in late February, about Apple being working with Goldman Sachs to release their own credit card. And this credit card would be integrated with the wallet app and have some exclusive features in the wallet app regarding this credit card, where you could like set your budget goals or change the limit on the card and set spending habit goals and things like that. So I found a new control that's implemented in Passkit UI, which is basically the user interface for the wallet app. And it looks like it's this thing that's been mentioned in the Wall Street Journal. And it's been added in iOS 12.2 and is not currently being used anywhere. And what it looks like is a ring that has a knob you can turn and it adjusts a numeric value. So, yeah, it's very interesting and it definitely looks like they are, in fact, working on something like that, where you be able to adjust some value using an activity ring-looking thing.
Right, and by activity ring, you mean like the rings we see in the activity app or on the Apple Watch, right? Like
exactly.
These like big colorful rings that go around a certain value.
Yeah, I can make it become colorful. I don't know. Yeah, it's probably not ready, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks like it will be able to have like multiple arcs, just like the one in the activity app. And you're going to be able to adjust them individually. That's what it looks like.
That could be something like, you know, you can set your budget. And it could also be something like, imagine, well, I'm thinking about this is, why would Apple do a credit card? And the obvious answer is to make money, right? Because the credit card industry is quite lucrative. But if you think about it more from like a UX perspective, why would Apple want to introduce something like this? And what I can think about is the advantage Apple has over like traditional banks is presumably their machine learning capabilities and AI capabilities are much, much stronger, even though that's something that we, you know, sometimes criticize Apple for, or we say that we wish that they would be better at.
And their UX capabilities as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But in terms of this, what I'm thinking is, how about a credit card that learns how you spend your money and learns like percentages of like how much of your percent of your spendings goes to something like your rent or to movies or to food, etc. And then imagine, now I'm just like, I'm really freestyling here, but imagine you could turn this knob, like you could adjust this budget and you would see how much money you'd be able to spend on these individual categories. So if the different arcs or the different segments of the circle are different categories of spending, you would see like, oh, if I make myself a $1,000 budget on this credit card, I would be able to spend $200 on food or something like that. So
yeah.
That could be interesting, I think.
Yeah, I don't know how far they're going to take it, but it could also be like investment goals or stuff like that. And you could get like streaks and you like all the gamification things they've done for exercise, they could do for finance. And it's incredibly similar psychologically when you think about it. It's like spending and saving money versus doing exercise and eating less.
Yeah.
It's they are very similar. Yeah, that they are good habits that have very similar balances involved in terms of you do more of these and less of that and you get a result at the end. So I think maybe the same mechanic could work, and that's what they're thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. The achievements could be really funny, and especially if you align them with Apple's own interest, it could be like, upgrade your iCloud plan, achievement unlocked, buy an app from the App Store every day for a whole month, achievement unlocked.
Buy AirPods.
Yeah, achievement unlocked, yeah.
You're now rich.
Exactly. Or the opposite, maybe. yeah, but it's interesting. It's interesting to hear all of this and to try to envision what they would do. And so far, Apple has been taking a little bit of you know, passive role, maybe you could call it, or rather they are dependent on other banks in order to roll out their financial features like Apple Pay and things like that. Apple Pay Cash they now have in certain countries. And, you know, of course, it makes sense when you think about it that they want to cut out the middleman, right? And in this case, they are partnering with some kind of bank, but you would imagine that the rates or the conditions they would get from this deal would be better than what they get from the banks.
Yeah, and they have Apple Pay and Apple Pay Cash.
Yeah, that's the infrastructure.
Given that those systems require a credit card or a debit card for them to work, Apple Pay Cash technically doesn't, but if you want to use it more, you either have to receive the money from like a friend and you only have that money to spend, or you have to charge it using a credit or a debit card. I think those are the options you have.
Yeah.
So if you want to make that easier for people, maybe you can cut off the middleman. Like, don't need a credit card anymore. You just set it up on the wallet app. And maybe there wouldn't even be a physical card involved. Maybe it would be only a virtual card.
Yeah, I mean, I would think so. I would definitely have a hard time believing that they would build a physical card. But if they do, I want one.
It would
one.
Definitely be a very pretty card.
Yeah, exactly. It would be the most elegant. It would probably just be a white card, nothing on it, right? Very, very simplistic. And no ports. That's important. No ports. And very thin and light.
Oh, of course.
The thinnest credit card ever made.
And it would be made of glass.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't drop it.
No, don't do it. Another important aspect here is that we mentioned on the last episode that you found some evidence of upsell dialogues in the OS. And this is something that we see Apple moving more and more towards, is they're doing more and more of their business around like services and things that you buy and sell digitally. And also, this makes me think that that must be also kind of a motivating factor here, where if they're going to rely on other credit cards and banks and things like that for all of this stuff, I mean, I guess they would also like to control that in-house as well. So if you have the Apple credit card, they don't have to pay all these fees for your iCloud subscription and all your movie rentals and your Apple Music subscription. That would all go through them.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And there are still some weirdnesses with the way Apple Pay works. Like, there's no connection between your iTunes store / App Store payment and Apple Pay.
No,
you have to set up a card separately for that. That doesn't make any sense. Basically, Apple doesn't accept Apple Pay.
Right. Yeah, that's because they have to go through the bank, right? They have to get the validation from the bank, so which they don't need if you're just using the bank's credit card for your Apple ID.
Yeah, and the Apple Store in Brazil does not accept Apple Pay yet, even though we have Apple Pay.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, so interesting stuff. We're going to see what's going to happen with all the money and wallets and credit cards. And let's see if we're going to get a Johnny Ive credit card edition, if that's going to be one of the products they launch. All right, so that's it for this week's Rambo Report, but we're not quite done with this episode yet, because Rambo, you've been doing another kind of alternative version of spelunking, we could call it, and it's less to do with reverse engineering and more to do with bureaucracy, and that you've been requesting all of your data that Apple has on you, and Apple has given that to you, which is a part of this whole GDPR thing that has happened in Europe and worldwide, where companies now have to offer some way for customers to get all the data that they have on you. So what kind of data does Apple have on you, Rambo? Is Spelunker equals true?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. They released this feature for European users first. And I don't know since then, but since a while now, it's been available to everyone. So you can go to appleid.apple.com, and there's a privacy section where you can request your data. And it's even interesting that during this process, I thought they would only provide you with like your metadata and the data you don't normally have access to. So the data that they keep about you, but that's not produced by you directly, like photos and notes. But that's not true. They actually, you can get all of your Apple data, even like your notes, your calendars, your photos, everything. I didn't do that because it would be a like 100 gigabyte download because of the photos mostly. But what I've done is I and they actually separate. There are two sections and you can like check all of them separately. And there's like the metadata section and then there's the your data section, which includes the photos. And so I just got the metadata section. And yeah, I'm looking at it right now and it's relatively small. It's 60 megabytes for all of it, but it's all text.
Yeah, so 60 megabytes of text is still quite a lot.
Yeah, so it's a bunch of stuff.
But this is dating back like only till when they announced this feature? Or no. Is it like from the beginning of time?
It's from the beginning of time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's your first event? Like, what's the first event that appears in the data?
Oh, let's do this. Let's spelunk my life.
title.
Yeah. I want to find it here. It's related to the Apple, to the App Store, I believe. All right. I found it.
Awesome. So what is it?
It's a file that's about my iTunes and app re-download and update history.
Okay.
And it's a 4 megabyte CSV file.
Wow.
So I'm scrolling to the bottom here. Numbers took quite a while to load it.
Yeah.
And the first ever item in there.
Cute drum roll. From,
yeah, it's from 2011, the 27th of January. 2011 at 7:09 a.m. and it's a download of iMovie for Mac.
Nice. That's your first encounter with Apple.
Yes. Actually, not because I've been using it since 2008, but I guess the Mac App Store and the App Store didn't exist back then. And
or like the system didn't exist or something like that.
Yeah. And I only had the iPhone after a while.
Right.
I think I got my first iPhone in 2011. I don't remember. And even logs the user agent. And we can see that I was using Intel Mac OS 10.6.6.
Nice.
So Snow Leopard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's yeah, amazing. It was very interesting. And it's interesting to scroll around this and see like old things that I downloaded, like an app named iFiles, which was a file manager for iOS. Well, I guess I did have an iPhone in 2011 because it's right after this one. Fresh Feeds, RSS News Notifier.
Oh, wow, yeah.
MPlayer X, remember MPlayer X?
No, I don't really.
Xcode for Snow Leopard.
Oh, nice. That's a good one.
Yeah.
And how granular is this data? Like, what kind of events do you have associated with each entry? Like, is it only the user agent and the time, or is there other metadata as well?
Yeah, so they are individual files for separate sections. So there's like Apple Online Store and Apple Store. So that's like when you go to the Apple Store or when you shop online. There's AppleCare, which includes transcripts of previous emails and chats I had with AppleCare when I had an issue with anything and I needed help. There's even history of a case I had with Apple Developer Support in there.
Oh, wow.
So even that's included. Which means they're storing that forever.
Yeah. Like, and it's one of those things, that? You know, when you call the bank, for example, they always say, this call will be recorded. And when you hear that, you're always thinking, oh, whatever. And then you just go about your business because you need to call the bank. But then they store that phone call possibly forever, right? And transcribe it like you're saying also and things like that. And yeah, it's kind of crazy when you see that after the fact, so many years later, and you're like, they're still keeping this around. And yeah, I mean, I'm not saying they're doing anything nefarious with it. I kind of trust Apple with all this data myself, but it's just interesting when you see it from this perspective.
Yeah, and the data collection aspect, we always talk about it in terms of what the company is doing with the data. That's what matters.
Yeah.
The most to me, at least. I mean, if you are dealing with a known company, you need to be careful, especially careful about data breaches as well.
Yeah.
There's no information in this whole collection that Apple has about me that is like compromising in any way. But there are some personal details such as previous addresses. There's a shipping address history from the Apple Store, which includes all addresses I've lived in so far, which are only two. But I bet for you it would be a lot more, right?
Oh, yeah, a lot more. I think more of something like 15 or 16 or something.
Yeah, but it's all there. And by the way, it's interesting that everything is, at least the top level folders where everything is in, they are localized. So they are in Portuguese. Because account is Brazilian, so I guess they use the language of your account, even though I use everything in English. So yeah, it's very interesting. And you asked about granularity. So for this particular file I'm looking at, which is iTunes and stuff and re-downloads, I'm scrolling back to the top, and it has the Apple ID number, so my Apple ID number, the activity date, which includes the dates with including the seconds. There's content type, which is either is it an iOS app, is it a Mac app, the Apple ID of the item, so the ID of the product, the app, the description, which is basically the title, the version, the seller, so the publisher of the app, the user agent, so the most recent ones include like App Store /3.0/iOS 12.2 /iPhone 11.
So the version 11, number and everything.
Yeah. iPhone 11.8, that's an iPhone XR, the build of the operating system, the IP address, and a device identifier, which looks like it's the identifier for vendor. Could be an IDFA, maybe. I'm not sure. But it's not like a unique device identifier. It's one of those ephemeral ones.
Right, exactly.
There are two files which were particularly interesting to me. One of them is, actually two, are the ones that list the device registration history. And there's one that is device registration history pre-iOS 8 and Yosemite. So they probably changed the system, and so that's why they are separate.
Yeah.
And the online purchase history from the Apple Store is interesting as well, because it lists all my purchases, including the shipping address, the order number, the invoice number, the payment methods, what was purchased. And it also includes the price without tax, with tax, and the tax rate, which is very interesting.
Well, that's probably also for like accountancy reasons and things like that.
Yeah, and for those who are not familiar with Brazilian finance, basically here it's not like in the US and some other countries where you have like the product and then you pay the sales tax. It's all like embedded into the price, so you usually don't know how much tax you're paying.
Yeah, same here in Europe as well, for the most part.
Yeah, and the tax rates, the I see here it's like 49%, 61%.
Oh wow, that's high.
It's Brazilian level tax rate.
Whoa, that's like you're buying alcohol or something. Like, say you're buying gasoline, something dangerous for society.
Yeah, because
hey, I'm just downloading Angry Birds.
Because Apple products here are imported goods, and stuff is extremely that high taxation here. But anyway, right. I don't want to get depressed. Yeah, there you go. It's very interesting. I recommend, if you'd like to see what Apple knows about you, you can download this data. We'll leave a link in the show notes. I think it's the direct link is like privacy.apple.com.
Cool. And yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's also a way to do like a backup of your information. If you want, you can ask to download like everything, including pictures and notes and email messages. So you can also use it as a backup.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's if you want to wait for that 100 megabyte plus download. But yeah, good way to back up potentially. Cool. So what do you say? Should we round off this episode by doing some Ask Stacktrace?
Of course. Let's go.
Let's do it. So just to remind everyone that you are more than welcome to send us questions for this show. All you have to do to send us a question is to tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace. If you do that, then we're going to see your question and hopefully we're going to answer it on a future episode. And do send us questions. We do really love to get any kind of questions, and they don't have to be related to programming. It can be anything you want to ask us. In fact, we're going to start with one which is not related to programming, which comes from Ulle. And Ulle wants to know, what email client do you use and why? So Rambo, which email app do you currently use?
Apple Mail.
Keeping it simple.
Yes. So I am a fan of using the built-in apps when possible. I use the Notes app, I use Reminders, I use Apple Music, I use Mail, I use Safari. I think if you are in the Apple ecosystem, you get more benefits from using the built-in apps. I mean, I know Mail is not a particularly good email client, but my usage of email is not that advanced. It's just receiving and replying to email. I don't need any of the fancy, like, send with a delay and cancel sending. Like, I've heard some people really like those features. But yeah, and I've tried other apps before. I don't remember any names particularly. But for me, it's like, it's simple. It works reliably. I don't know, it doesn't for everyone, but for me it does. And yeah, it does the job very well for me. So I don't see why I shouldn't use it.
Yeah. I'm the same. I also use Apple Mail for similar reasons. I like to also use built-in apps. I also think it's a good app. Like, I think it's a good email client. And I know some people don't like it, but I kind of do. Also, for me, it has to do a little bit with privacy and security. I trust Apple to not, like, scan all my email and try to sell me ads based on it or something like that, or store it on their servers, because, you know, I do a lot of business over email and I don't want, like, client information or something that like that to get into the wrong hands. And while I'm saying all this, I should also point out that I am using Google for my actual email, which kind of might sound like contradictory, but I am using the Google for Business, like the G Suite, as they call it, Google
Yeah,
Suite.
Yeah, me too.
And that one is a little bit different. Like, apparently they don't use that for data harvesting. So let's hope that they actually don't do that. And the reason for the setup also is, I also kind of like the setup because the Gmail part of it actually has some smarts built into it, like when it comes to putting things in folders, and you can set up rules, and it's easier to do that, I think, in the Gmail interface and all the tools that Google offers. And then the Apple Mail app on both iOS and on the Mac, they're just clients, like just clients to access that data. So I think that works out pretty well.
Yeah, and I don't use the Mail app too much on my iPhone. I don't do much email on my iPhone. I use it a little bit more on iPad, but where I really do emails is on my Mac. So I know many people use third-party clients because they can't stand Apple Mail on iPhone. But for me, for the little I use it on iPhone, it's okay to me. But on the Mac, I really think it's really good. It's a really good Mac app.
I use my iPad now for most of my emailing. I try to use the iPad now for all the tasks that I don't have to use the Mac for. And email is definitely one of those. And yeah, I think it's a great app. It works great and I don't have any complaints.
Yeah. And the privacy aspect you mentioned is very important, because many people don't realize that many of these third-party clients, they use servers to do the hard work.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but means you need to pipe your email through their servers, and even though they may not be storing anything, I don't know, it's just, yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah,
very important things happen through email.
Yeah, they do, and a lot of services use email as the last line of defense, you know, and things like that. So I'm just very careful with email, and that's kind of why I keep it basic.
Yeah, and with two-factor and strong passwords.
Exactly. All right, and our next and final question for this episode comes from Tom. And Tom wants to know if we are using automation in our workflows. Like, do we use shortcuts? Do we use Automator? Do we use Apple Script? Like, how much of your life is currently automated, Rambo?
People are going to be so disappointed. Yeah, I mean, I don't use automation that much as in making cool shortcuts like our friend Vitici does, and like taking all sorts of tasks and automating them. But I do use shortcuts on iOS. I use like the download from YouTube shortcut a lot, the download videos shortcut. I use Vitici's iPhone frame shortcuts that adds like the iPhone device frame to screenshots a lot. So I am automating that part of my workflow. For 9 to 5 Mac, like, I don't know if this can be called automation, but I created a template in Sketch for the featured image for my articles that I always use. Yeah, and I also use the device frames shortcut to make that happen when there are device images in the screenshots. Because for posting on a website, especially if it's like a featured image, I noticed that putting the device frame around the screenshot makes it look a lot better, especially now with the notch and everything. I use that, and being a programmer, I have many, many little tools I wrote, especially around my spelunking work. So I automated the hard work involved in that is automated, and the analysis part is still manual because I haven't trained a machine learning algorithm to spelunk for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that's basically it. I would say I'm very, I use very little automation.
All right. Maybe more in the future.
But I know you're different.
I am. Yeah. I love to automate things. I see it as a little bit like a fun thing. Like, if you have something you have to do over and over again, for me, it gets repetitive, it gets boring, and also you increase the risk of making mistakes because it's repetitive and boring, and you kind of, you know, do it almost in your sleep. So whenever I have something like that, whether it's like generating invoices for clients or publishing an article, which, you know, it's fun, I love to write articles, but the actual publishing of it, which includes doing the syntax highlighting with Splash, generating HTML from that, and processing my markdown that I've written and put it on my website, all of those things I automate. And to go through the list here that Tom suggested, do I use shortcuts for that? No. Do I use Automator? No. Do I use Apple Script? No. But I use Swift. I build almost all of my automation in Swift. So I have my scripting tool that I made called Marathon, and that enables me to write Swift scripts in Xcode and easily execute them on the command line. So that's what I use for all of these different things. I have used shortcuts a little bit on the iPad, but I'm definitely not like a pro shortcuts person yet, but definitely I want to explore that more. I think it's super cool. And it has also helped me with some just simple tasks. Like, for example, I needed to count the number of words in a string once because I was writing a ad for a sponsor. And to do that, I wrote a little shortcut for that because I only had my iPad at the time. So I do always like to automate stuff whenever I can. And it's not always because I think, oh, it's going to save me so much time. But sometimes it's just for fun because I just love when I can create a tool or something that helps me do something in a kind of programmatic way, because I just really like that.
Mr. Automation,
that's me. All right, but this show is not automated yet, so we'll still be back like it was automated next week with our special poker episode for the upcoming Apple Media event, which we are really looking forward to. Before that, you can find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell, and Mr. Rambo is at _inside. And you can find the show notes in your podcast player of choice or by heading over to 9to5mac.com. Once again, big thanks to Hyper for sponsoring this episode. Make sure to check out their awesome offer with 50% discount on their charging products in the show notes as well. And thanks so much for listening, everybody. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.